It is Friday, April the 21st. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, the Islamic State claiming responsibility for a deadly attack in Paris. Also ahead, the U.S. president taking aim at the nuclear agreement with Iran.
They are not living up to the spirit of the agreement, I can tell you that. And we're analyzing it very, very carefully, and we'll have something to say about it in the not-too-distant future.
Also ahead, tensions over Boko Haram along the Niger-Nigeria border. Plus, we'll look at the new movie, The Promise. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The Islamic State group has claimed responsibility for the shooting on the Champs-Élysées in Paris that left a police officer dead and two others gravely wounded. Some of the sounds along the avenue there, the attacker opened fire on a police van before he was killed. And French President François Hollande says he is convinced the circumstances surrounding the attack on the Paris police officers points definitely to a terrorist attack.
Et nous sommes convaincus que les
President's candidates also, the candidates for the presidential election, have expressed some solidarity with the police. The 11 candidates were appearing on a television program ahead of the first round of voting in the two-part election when the attack happened. Conservative contender François Fillon said on French television he was canceling his planned campaign stops today. Far-right candidate Marine Le Pen took to Twitter to offer her sympathy for the law enforcement officers. That attack came just days before the first round of voting in France's presidential election. International Edition's Lori London asked Paris-based reporter Catherine Field what's at stake and how the process works.
It's a two-stage process. In the first round, you have any candidate who has managed to get at least 500 signatures from elected officials across the country. He or she is allowed to stand. So in the first round, there will be 11 candidates. If none of the candidates wins the majority of the votes cast, then it goes to a second round runoff 2 weeks later. It's a system that what the French say is in the first round you vote with your heart and the second round you vote with your head. Another way of putting it is you're in the first round you vote for the person who you really like and the second round you vote against the person you don't like.
Well, so is the job of president actually important in France?
It's incredibly important. The president of France has got a lot of power. He's able to launch a nuclear strike. He can dissolve parliament. He can bring in a state of emergency. He has got a lot of power. So much of the actual power rests in the hands of the president, who lives in a palace in the center of Paris. And in fact, he still has a lot of the trappings of the Napoleonic era. You get these guards with wonderful uniforms, and you get ushered into these wonderful stately reception rooms. And he really is treated like an emperor.
The world is watching. Why do you think this election in particular is so significant to people in other places that are watching?
First of all, we've had the election of Donald Trump in the United States. And we've also had the vote in the United Kingdom to leave the European Union. So there's this feeling of, well, is the populist message coming across? But don't forget, at the same time, we've also had two elections in Europe, one for the Austrian president and one for parliamentary elections in the Netherlands, and they very clearly showed a move against these sort of populist candidates. So it's very important. Also, whoever wins these elections will set the tone for Europe for the next decade at least. If it goes to a candidate who's anti-European Union and perhaps talks about leaving the European Union, then that would be the end of the European project. If it goes to someone who's very keen on the European Union, then that will really cement the European Union. It'll put it back in its place, and it will again be the political and the economic anchor for Europe's stability.
France has been under a nationwide state of emergency since November of 2015, and there seems to also be sort of a growing anti-Muslim environment.
Several aspects there. Yes, security is a huge issue here. Just 2 days ago, police arrested two men who were, they say, about to launch an attack which would have been very deadly. They found in their possession explosives, guns, and they said that they were about to commit an attack at a political rally somewhere in the country. So that threat of a serious and imminent attack is still there. So you've got that, the risk of attacks at rallies. You've also got, according to the Interior Minister, the threat of some sort of violence on Election Day. And so they have deployed an extra 50,000 police officers and gendarmes to guard the 67,000 polling stations across the country. On top of that, you also have the risk of outside interference, such as hacking, when it comes to the transmission of the results. So electronic security has been stepped up there. When it comes to the Muslim community, yes, indeed. As we've seen, the far-right candidate, Marine Le Pen of the National Front, as she's been going around the country on the stump, giving lots of speeches, her rhetoric has been really turning against people that they are actually putting a question mark as to whether they really are truly French citizens. Just within the last few days, as she's been trying to rally her troops, some of the comments she's been making about how some of these people could possibly have their French citizenship taken away from them, this caused a lot of concern. On the one side, you do have this very large Muslim population who now feel that they're under threat, and you also have these large Christian communities who support Marine Le Pen and the National Front who now feel it's okay to say what in the past they didn't feel was okay to say in public.
It would appear also, similarly to what's happening in the U.S., that there's also somewhat of a growing anti-refugee movement growing there.
There is. What I put it down to is it does seem to now be acceptable to say remarks in public, not just people standing on street corners and shouting it out, but also for some politicians to bring up the fact that these refugees are here and that they are costing money and perhaps they should go somewhere else. And that's what I've really seen in the last 2 weeks with this campaign, is that this sort of comment is now acceptable comment in public in France. And that's really turned against some of these migrants who have come up through the Mediterranean and who really are desperate. And this has also coincided with the fact that it's now spring in Europe, and you've got more of these people arriving up, coming across the Mediterranean in rickety boats, hoping for some sort of refuge here.
That is journalist Catherine Field in Paris speaking with my colleague, Lori London. This is VOA.
Next on Let's Talk. Interior design. What does it take to be one? Is it for a specific gender only? Well, join me next Monday on Let's Talk, and we'll discuss this, of course, in our usual light-hearted manner. So please, stay tuned.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. The last rebel fighters have departed the besieged town of Zabadani near Damascus, part of a reciprocal evacuation agreement between Damascus, the Syrian leadership, and the opposition that involves four towns. Two Sunni towns, Zabadani and Badaya, have been controlled by rebels, while two Shiite towns, Afwa and Kifraya, were held by pro-government civilians and fighters. Pro-government evacuees were bused to Aleppo, while those transported out of rebel-held towns were taken to Idlib province. The evacuations involved tens of thousands of people who were postponed following last weekend's massive explosion on a convoy leaving Afwa and Kafraya that left more than 120 people dead, including dozens of them children. Trinity University analyst and Syria specialist David Lesh tells International Edition's Victor Beatty this represents a specific strategy by the government of Bashar al-Assad to retake territory through so-called reconciliation agreements, piece by piece.
Because they don't have the manpower or resource base to militarily take, you know, town by town, city by city. So they've had to use all sorts of tactics, from preventing food supplies from entering towns, from withholding humanitarian aid, to bludgeoning the population with remote bombing from the air and from artillery, that, you know, almost compels civilian populations and the rebels' forces who may be holding out there to finally submit in the end in order to survive. And that's one of the reasons the Syrian regime needs the Idlib province, which is held mostly by opposition forces, to act as this kind of safe haven for these rebels that are being evacuated from all of these towns. And so this has been a specific strategy. It has worked to a certain degree in recapturing territory, especially key passages and key towns strategically in Syria. You know, the real question from my perspective is, you know, how long are these reconciliation agreements going to last? While there have been some successes, word is that in many towns and cities where there have been reconciliation agreements, the civilian population is getting very restless because they're not getting what they were promised. They're not getting their infrastructure rebuilt. They're not getting government services restored, salaries and protection and things of that nature. The government bought some time because most people just wanted to escape the horrors of war, but now demanding more in terms of services and protection, and the government just doesn't have the resources to do that. So that's something to keep an eye on, I think, as things move forward and as there may be more of these reconciliation agreements.
Is this a sign the rebels are finished?
No, I don't think it's a sign the rebels are finished at all. They may have to adjust their tactics from a resistance that is holding territory to more of a guerrilla insurgency, which actually requires less state support from the outside. That may be, you know, what we are witnessing if it continues to progress. But, you know, as long as the rebels still hold some territory in southern Syria, as well as the Idlib province, they still have base of operations. The question is, you know, what is going to happen in the Idlib province eventually? Is there going to be a day of reckoning when the Syrian government and the forces that are supporting the Syrian government in Syria try to take back that province as they took back the city of Aleppo?
David Lesh said it could be a short-lived arrangement. Once Islamic State is defeated, he said, Syrian-backed forces with Russian help may turn their attention to Idlib province, controlled mostly by the al-Qaeda affiliate, to try to take it back. Meantime, he said, the suffering of the Syrian people does continue, and when a political settlement is reached, Lesh said it could take a generation and maybe $300 billion to reconstruct the ravaged country, but he said the psychological and emotional damage done could take even longer. And on that subject, UN Special Envoy for Syria, Staffan de Mistura, says that U.S., Russian, and UN trilateral talks on Syria, scheduled for Monday, have been postponed. That story now from Lisa Schlein at the UN in Geneva.
Staffan de Mistura says he does not know why the United States has decided not to turn up at the meeting early next week, but believes Washington remains committed to the three-way discussions on the Syrian situation.
I would say that the indications I got from Washington is exactly that there is clearly an intention to maintain and resume these trilateral meetings, and the date and the circumstances were not conducive for this to happen on Monday, but that is certainly their intention.
In the meantime, de Mistura says he will be holding what he calls a very intense bilateral meeting on Monday with Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Gennady Gatilov. He says there are many things to discuss regarding the upcoming meeting in the Kazakh capital, Astana, and on the Geneva peace talks.
Regarding Astana, it's still on as forecasted. We will be involved again on the senior technical level in order to support what at the moment doesn't seem to be working, which is a cessation of hostilities.
Russia, Turkey, and Iran are sponsors of the Astana negotiations on May 3rd and 4th, which will focus on arranging a ceasefire in Syria so peace talks in Geneva can go ahead. De Mistura says he will be carefully watching developments on the ground to make sure the talks, which are to resume sometime in May, have the best possible chance of success. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations took aim at Iran and its proxy militia, Hezbollah, on Thursday, saying the United States could act against the growing menace. At the monthly meeting of the U.N. Security Council that focuses on the Middle East, specifically the Israeli-Palestinian issue, Nikki Haley said the council could expand the attention to focus on other threats in the region. Trump administration said this week that it is conducting a 90-day review of the nuclear deal to evaluate whether suspending Iran's sanctions are in the vital interest of U.S. national security. President Trump mentioned the Iran agreement at a Thursday news conference.
It was a terrible agreement. It shouldn't have been signed. It shouldn't have been negotiated the way it was negotiated. I'm all for agreements, but that was a bad one, as bad as I've ever seen negotiated. They are not living up to the spirit of the agreement, I can tell you that. And we're analyzing it very, very carefully, and we'll have something to say about it in the not-too-distant future.
In February, the Trump administration designated for sanctions 25 individuals and entities for their support for Iran's ballistic missile program or for their support for Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Nigeria's northern neighbor Niger continues to feel the effects of the Boko Haram insurgency. Facing challenges such as restoring education and food security, Niger is making a slow but steady recovery. Reporter Nicholas Pinot visited Boso, a city that has historical significance in the region. It was the first city attacked in Niger by Boko Haram back in 2015. He spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about Boso and how citizens are trying to resume their lives after Boko Haram.
Yeah, historically, during the fight with Boko Haram here in Niger, you have to understand that Boso was the first city to be attacked in February 2015. You know, a few days before, they attacked Malam Fattori in Nigeria, like a few kilometers from the border. And Boso was the first major city to be attacked in the morning by Boko Haram fighters. You know, it's really important, that city, because it shows you the evolution of the fight against Boko Haram in Niger. So, first attack was in February 2015, and then they attacked again in June 2016. And what's important is that back in 2016, the Niger army had to retreat because they could not, you know, support the fight, and the Boko Haram members, they occupied the city for 24 hours. Now we are in April 2017, and we have to say that the situation has changed, because basically, you know, life, you know, slowly is getting back to normal. School has reopened back in October 2016. I was able to visit the school. You have temporary shelters and you have some buildings. You have about 1,000 students, range from 5 years old to 11 years old in the class. Obviously, it's very hot in the tents and in the shelters, but, you know, they're trying to build something new and something normal in Boso. You have a huge contingent of Chadian army. The Niger army is around the city, but the city of Boso itself is secured by the army of Chad. So you have hundreds of Chadian soldiers patrolling the city, especially around the school, to make sure that the Boko Haram fighters, they don't try to attack the city.
Another big challenge that is going on right now in that area is also food security. Can you tell us about what the food situation is like now?
Mainly in the Diffa region where Boso is, it is challenging. According to UNICEF, 12,000 kids under 5 will suffer malnutrition this year. And overall, Niger is in Sahel, the region. You know, each year is very difficult because of high temperatures and the drought. According to the World Food Program in Niger itself, 1.5 million people live in food insecurity. So we have to be clear, there's no famine here like you have in South Sudan, but still you have some tough cases. I was able to visit a center for mothers and children here in Diffa, and you know you have kids very, very, very in danger. I can remember a kid being 2 years old, and he was barely weighing 12 pounds, which is like very, very difficult to see like for any parents. So the situation is not like what you have across the border with Nigeria, but still, you have some concern here.
Looking ahead, what do you see in the future, in the next few months for that particular town?
So right now we are at the beginning of this challenge, and many, many doctors and experts in the region, they say the next coming months, you know, right before the rainy season, you're going to have more and more cases. This is usually the peak for malnutrition here in Niger. So they're prepared to face that challenge.
That was reporter Nicholas Pinot. He was speaking with Kim Lewis. She's host of the VOA program Africa News Tonight. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
When we see someone yawn or scratch an itch, sometimes we can't help but respond in kind. For many years, many scientists have thought that this behavior was an empathic or psychological response. A new study by researchers at the Washington University School of Medicine proposes that the mimicked scratching response is controlled by chemicals released in the brain. In the study, researchers showed mice videos of other mice scratching themselves. The scientists noticed that the videos evoked a similar behavior in the live mice. The scientists then found that whenever a mouse saw another one scratch, a chemical called GRP would be released by a part of its brain that controls wake-sleep functions. When the researchers blocked the GRP in the mouse brain, they found that mice would no longer mimic scratching behavior as observed in video. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Well, a new movie out there starring Oscar winner Christian Bale and Charlotte LeBon, it's called The Promise, tells the story of a love triangle set against the background of the Armenian genocide in World War I. VOA's David Byrd reports the movie has generated controversy because of its painful and difficult subject.
Mikhail Bogosian, played by Oscar Isaac, is an Armenian medical student who wants to study in Istanbul. But he is from a poor village, so he pledges himself to marry a wealthy woman named Maral so her dowry will pay for his studies. While in Istanbul, Mikhail meets Anna, played by Charlotte LeBon, who is also Armenian but is the lover of an Associated Press reporter, Chris Myers, played by Christian Bale. Mikhail and Anna fall in love just as the Ottoman Empire begins to round up Armenians at the beginning of the Armenian Genocide in 1915. Mikhail manages to escape conscription in the Turkish army, but when he tries to save his uncle from prison, ends up in a Turkish prison camp. Mikhail escapes, returns to his village, marries Maral, and they seek refuge in a mountain cabin. A difficult pregnancy sends the couple back to the village. When Mikhail goes to a Red Cross camp to meet Chris and Anna, the village is massacred. Mikhail and Anna then join a group of resistance fighters hoping to fight off the Ottoman army long enough to be rescued by the French Navy. Christian Bale says that The Promise has a lot to say in the modern world.
I wish it was a totally irrelevant film, but it's not, you know. I mean, I was watching the Yazidis up the mountain when I was reading the script. You had Hitler ask, you know, does anybody remember the Armenian genocide? And genocides have continued, you know, in Cambodia and in the Ukraine and '30s, and it's just terribly relevant.
The Promise is directed by Oscar winner Terry George, who also wrote and directed 2004's Hotel Rwanda. He says that movies need to address difficult subjects and not be just about making money.
Schindler's List defines the Holocaust for most people. The Killing Fields, Cambodia, Hotel Rwanda with Rwanda, Missing on the Chilean repression, The English Patient. These are the films that people go to and come out, and they don't quickly forget them. And if we lose that genre because of this instant profit, then we'll have lost a big chunk of the art of filmmaking?
Charlotte Le Bon says she felt a special responsibility in playing Anna in a story set in such a difficult and controversial time.
Even though there was a lot of information already on the page, I mean, it was also our job to try to find something that would not necessarily be said, but that would be maybe felt, or hopefully. But I remember wanting to bring more love to the relationship that Anna had with Chris, because it was really important for me to show that it wasn't like just one or the other, that she was really torn between those two men.
The film premiered at last year's Toronto Film Festival and was the subject of controversy on the Internet Movie Database website. Though only a few thousand people had seen it last year, thousands of reviews were posted on IMDb, giving it the lowest rating. Thousands of other ratings gave it 10 stars. It was determined the majority of these ratings were given by people who had not seen the film. The low ones came from Turkish voters, while Armenian voters posted the high ratings. The Promise also stars Armenian actress Angela Sarafian as Miral, and Iranian actress Shohreh Aghadashloo as Mikhail's mother. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
And many thanks to you, Dave. A couple of more stories. Motown's songwriter Sylvia Moy, the recording studio's first female producer who penned or collaborated on several hits, including Stevie Wonder's My Sharia Moore and Marvin Gaye's It Takes Two, has died. She was 78. Moy started her career as a singer, but she knew she had the ability to write songs, and she said that's what she wanted to do. Motown founder Berry Gordy gave Moy her first shot, but with a catch. He said she had to come up with something for the rising young singer, Stevie Wonder. And she did it, didn't she, huh? U.S. federal judges blocked a sound engineer from releasing a 5-song album of unpublished music by Prince after the late superstar's estate objected. One of the songs is available online. The estate's lawsuit said that the engineer signed a confidentiality agreement that the recordings would remain Prince's property. Listen, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America, an international edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead, so we hope that you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Dave Magnus, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a super Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On April 22nd, more than 190 countries, including the United States, celebrate Earth Day. It is a day to reflect on the impact humans have on the Earth and to demonstrate and reaffirm our support for environmental protection. The first Earth Day was planned as a teach-in, a day to inform about environmental issues. Earth Day's founder, United States Senator Gaylord Nelson, an environmental activist who was outraged by the lack of political response to gross environmental degradation throughout the country, said that he was convinced that all we need to do to bring an overwhelming insistence of the new generation that we stem the tide of environmental disaster is to present the facts clearly and dramatically. Every university should set aside one day in the school year, the same day across the nation, for the teach-in. His plan worked. Over 20 million people turned up for Senator Nelson's first Earth Day teach-in on April 22, 1970. And from then on, the movement grew spontaneously, creating its own momentum with no central organization. Today, we continue the traditions of that first Earth Day. Because education is the foundation of progress, this year's theme is environmental and climate literacy. Citizens who understand well the importance of these issues and the impact they have on our lives can make small changes to minimize their impact on the environment and influence environmental practices within their communities, even influence environmental policy. By choosing to buy environmentally safe products and to do business with environmentally responsible producers and vendors, they can also accelerate green innovations, technologies, and jobs. On April 22, 1970, in his speech on the first Earth Day, Senator Nelson said, "Our goal is an environment of decency, quality, and mutual respect for all human beings and all other creatures. Our goal is a decent environment in its deepest and broadest sense." Today, these words still resonate as strongly as they did 47 years ago. We are committed to advancing these goals and ideas across the country and across the globe.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.